Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Alonso de Arguete, active on the Iberian Peninsula during the first half of the 16th century, initially trained as a painter before becoming known for his painted sculptures in wood. Alonso de Arguete, first sculptor of Renaissance Spain, is the first major exhibition held outside Spain to celebrate de Arguete's expressive art. The exhibition presents more than 40 works from across the artist's career, including early paintings and the largest group of his drawings ever to be assembled, along with an unprecedented number of sculptures. These works range from single figures to large sections of multi-story altarpieces, or retablos, that combine reliefs, statues, paintings, and architectural details. In this lecture, delivered on October 14, 2019, curator C.D. Dickerson III provides an overview to this exhibition of work by de Arguete, the preeminent sculptor of Renaissance Spain.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming out on a decently nice fall afternoon. My name is C.D. Dickerson. I'm the head of sculpture and decorative arts here at the National Gallery of Art. And we've already achieved something historic. Never in the history of this country have more than five people assembled in the same room to contemplate the subject of my talk. The subject of our new exhibition, Alonso de Arguete, first sculptor of Renaissance Spain. I'm here to tell his fascinating story, and it's a story that begins on the plains of northern Castile. By Castile, I mean the lands of northwestern and central Spain that formed the ancient Kingdom of Castile, then ruled over by Queen Isabella of Castile and her husband, King Ferdinand of Aragon. De Arguete was born right here in this small town of Paredes de Nava around 1488. Thus, just before that momentous year in world history, 1492, when Queen Isabella agreed to sponsor Christopher Columbus's maiden voyage to the New World, and also just before, she and her husband turned Spain upside down by ordering the expulsion of all Jews and Muslims. Even in remote Paredes de Nava, the winds of change must have been blowing as the young Alonso de Arguete took his first steps as a toddler. And to give you some sense of that place, here's a little clip I took on a very windy day in May. And yes, you're correct. It's not much of a place. Certainly a far cry from where de Arguete would end up as the wealthiest and most celebrated artist active in Renaissance Spain. Now, there was at least one redeeming feature of Paredes de Nava. It was the home and the site of the principal workshop of one of the most important painters who was active in Castile during the final decades of the 15th century, a man who also happened to be Alonso de Arguete's father, the great painter Pedro de Arguete. Pedro is represented in our exhibition with this absolutely jewel of a painting, which helps us understand the artistic world into which de Arguete was born, which he would be raised, and ultimately the artistic world that he would go on to overthrow. De Arguete must have trained at the side of his father as a painter, and as he advanced through his adolescence, early teenage years, learned to produce precisely this kind of painting, which is executed in what we call the Hispano-Flemish style. The term pays homage to the fact that it betrays the characteristics and the influence of Northern European painting, paintings from Flanders, from the Netherlands, and for many reasons having to do with the strong economic and political links between, especially Flanders, down to Castile. There was a great number of Northern European pictures by artists like Roger van der Weyden, Jan van Eyck, coming down to Castile, as well as artists trained in that manner who would come and work in Castile. The principal characteristics which you see here is great optical refinement. This painting's only about this big. And when you come in on little details like the jewels, this depiction of sculpture here, and then also when you consider the depiction of architecture, it bears the characteristics of Gothic architecture with the pointed arches and the intricate tracery. These are all qualities that would disappear from Berghetti's mature style as he advanced. In the exhibition, we make the point about the interface between Castile and Northern Europe during the time that Berghetti was born, with a comparison like this one. This is a quite large sculpture of the flight into Egypt that is obviously loosely based on a print by Martin Schungauer, a printmaker working in the north. And we have to assume that tens of thousands of prints by artists from the north were flowing into Castile during the 15th century, and again, providing inspiration for artists such as the one who sculpted this work, which is probably from the 1490s, executed in Castile. When you look at the sculpture of the time, you'll notice a great steeledness, a kind of generic quality in the figures. They're not especially lifelike or naturalistic, very little movement. We'll look at another example. We have this stupendous work in alabaster, about this big, this little figure. And it was originally positioned, I think, right here on one of the most impressive tombs executed during the 1490s in Castile by Gil de Silouet. This is the tomb of Isabella's parents. And again, when you look at a sculpture like this and think about the Hispano-Flemish style, you think about great refinement, the attention to detail in the beard, the use of gilding to accentuate the robe, crinkly drapery, kind of elongated bodily features. Again, in the early part of the exhibition, we're just kind of setting up exactly where Berghetti would go from. Now, in terms of altarpieces, and altarpieces would become one of the principal genres in which Alonzo Berghetti would practice, you see here that they are, again, conceived very much in a Gothic style. This is the great high altarpiece, the retablo mayor. I'll use the word retablo, the Spanish word for altarpiece, throughout the lecture. The retablo mayor in Toledo Cathedral, executed 1499 to 1505. Let me come in closer. And again, you'd see the incredible intricacy of the Gothic tracery that is used to conceive the architecture. And then when you look at some of the figures, a stillness, a sense of a generic quality that graces the figure's face, such as here, the kind of crinkly drapery, and the sense of refinement. Now, we know that in 1504, Alonzo Berghetti was standing where I was standing to take this picture. We know that he went to Toledo in 1504 to recoup debts that were owed to his father, who had died the previous year. Pedro Berghetti had been in Toledo Cathedral working on a series of frescoes. He dies 1503. The young Alonzo Berghetti goes with an uncle to recoup those debts. And so he would have undoubtedly gone to the great cathedral and look at this altarpiece. After succeeding in his business there, he must have gone back from Toledo back to Predis Nanava. And it turns out that probably 1 or 2 years later, he took a life-altering decision that would shape the course of his art forever. And that was the decision to relocate to Italy, where he would remain for the better part of a decade. He probably catches a ride with the Bishop of Burgos, who we know goes there about 1507. He's first recorded in Rome around 1508. And we know through documents and other sources that among the first people he has an interaction with is Michelangelo. Somehow he's able to secure a friendship, an acquaintance with Michelangelo, and Michelangelo makes arrangements for Alonzo to go to Florence to study his great cartoon of the Battle of Cascina. This was a large work on paper that was preparatory for a fresco that Michelangelo was planning to execute. Unfortunately, it was destroyed in 1512, but there were a number of copies such as this one made. And ultimately, this work, in many ways, kind of becomes the repository of the figural language that Berghetti would use throughout the course of his career. These kinds of twisting bodies, the kind of expression, the movement, the torquing, very different from what we were seeing with the Hispano-Flemish style, and it made a great impact on his imagination. Another thing that we hear about Berghetti, during his time in Italy involves the famous sculpture of the Laocoon, which had been recently excavated in Rome. Vasari tells the story that Alonso Beraghetti was invited to participate in a competition to make a small wax model to try to imagine how this really looked restored with a number of other artists. He didn't win. The quite famous sculptor Jacopo Sansovino ended up winning the competition, but the fact that the competition was presided over the great architect Bramante, that it was judged by Raphael, suggests quite powerfully that Beraghetti was very much working his way up in the artistic world at this time. This is the only evidence we have early on of Beraghetti doing anything that involves sculpture. But I point out that it was quite routine for painters at this point in time to have a facility making small wax models. So that's perhaps how he got involved with the competition. Ultimately, what we know from sources is that Beraghetti established his principal base of activity in Florence, and there he really devoted himself to painting. We have about three or four paintings that survive by Beraghetti. These are two of them. The one on the left from the Uffizi is in the exhibition. And what these paintings tell us is that Beraghetti was very much in the vanguard of the movement called Mannerism. This was kind of a very elegant style of painting where artists were questioning how to change the norms of nature to make something that was even more perfect and beautiful. And you see the way he's doing that in the articulation of these very, very long limbs, the gaze of the figure here. The painting on the right betrays the debt of the sculptor Donatello with this very close back and forth between Madonna and child. But again, if you look at the musculature, the strange fingers, here's Beraghetti showing us that he's working alongside painters like Rosso Fiorentino, Pontormo, and very much, I don't think necessarily being a follower, but he's right in that mix with them, being a great innovator and pioneer of Mannerist painting. The other important thing that Beraghetti learns while he is in Italy is the art of drawing. Beraghetti is the first Spanish artist to have a recognizable corpus of drawings. Doubtless, Spanish artists in the 15th century made drawings, but we have barely any of them, which is a suggestion of the importance which they attached to the value of drawing. In Italy, it was a completely different situation. Drawing was absolutely a fundamental part of how artists created their ideas, how they studied other works of art, and how they communicated with their assistants. And we know that Beraghetti was learning the art of drawing while he was there. The drawing on the right is after Michelangelo's prophet Daniel from the Sistine Ceiling. Evidently, Beraghetti had achieved access into the Sistine Ceiling. It wasn't a matter of just buying a ticket and walking into the Sistine Ceiling in those days. Maybe he was looking at another drawing of the Sistine Ceiling by an artist. The other drawing that I show here is loosely based on Masaccio's figure of Adam. It's been reversed, and this seems to be a live model. He's holding a sack up here in order to keep that pose while Beraghetti is drawing him from life. And this idea of drawing from life, again, that wasn't something Spanish. This was very much Italian and would stay with Beraghetti for the rest of his career. In 1518, Beraghetti's been in Italy for at least a decade. He decides to go back to Spain. And the reason he seems to decide to go back at that particular moment is that there's a new king overseeing both Castile and Aragon. And it's the King Charles I, who would later become the immensely powerful Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. And the first place that Charles I establishes court is in the town of Zaragoza, right here in Aragon. And that's where Beraghetti is recorded in 1518. Many, many artists from all over assembled in Zaragoza at that point in time, hoping for all sorts of great favors to be bestowed on them by the king. And Beraghetti was in a good spot because we know from documents that he was then hired to be Charles I's court painter. And it becomes quite clear how Charles I might have landed on that particular decision when we consider the kind of painting that was happening in Saragossa at this point in time. This is a painting we have in the exhibition by an artist. We don't know his name. He goes by the Master of Sigena after a small town just north of Saragossa. But this represents the most fashionable style of painting that was then happening in Aragon at this point in time. And it's quite a bizarre manner when you begin to look at the faces of the Adoration of the Magi. And interestingly, this is supposed to be a depiction of the young Charles I here as one of the Magi with the Habsburg emblem of his family up above. But the way the space is very compressed, if you look at these draperies, the emphasis on rich decoration and brocade, and the use of these really bright colors, very different from when we put something by Beraghetti, executed almost precisely at the same time, next to it. And you can imagine that Charles I and his advisors looked at Beraghetti's painting style and realized that this was the real future and that they wanted to perhaps attach themselves to the future of painting. So he was awarded, again, that position as Charles's court painter in 1518. Now, if things might have been a little backward-looking in terms of painting in Aragon, it was actually a really kind of momentous moment for sculpture there. Saragossa, as well as nearby Barcelona, became kind of a mecca for sculpture at this point in time, with several very important sculptors, including ones who had been in Italy, coming to work there. And we've illustrated this with two exquisite works, both of which were executed right about 1518-19, while Beraghetti was in Aragon. The one on the left is a Lamentation of Christ that's executed in walnut, very low relief, while we have a marble Saint Sebastian on the right, and thereby a sculptor named Bartolomeo Ordóñez, who was very much like Beraghetti in having been born in Castile. He then worked in Naples and came back to Barcelona about 1517. And he had really completely imbibed the Italianate matter. This work in particular shows the characteristics of the low relief style of Donatello, the forceful emotions, if you look at the swooning virgin here, and then sort of the sensual quality of this Saint Sebastian with his dreamy look. This betrays some knowledge of Michelangelo and works like his Dying Slave. So there were really quite progressive, interesting things going on. It's a reminder that there's a lot of sort of cross-fertilization happening, a lot of different impulses from Italy coming into Spain at this point in time. And I have to think that Bartolomeo Ordóñez would have gone on to be the great Renaissance sculptor if sadly he hadn't died the next year in 1520, which in a way really kind of opened the door perhaps for someone like Beraghetti to go into the world of sculpture. But again, we don't have any real evidence that he was practicing as a sculptor at this point in time. 1519, he's recorded in Barcelona with the new king. He then goes with the king all the way up here to La Coruña, and we have documents that he helps to paint the banners and the sails of Charles V's boat that will then take him up to Northern Europe. While Charles is away from the Iberian Peninsula, he sends Beraghetti all the way down to Granada, where he's entrusted with a commission to help decorate the Capilla Real, a space that Charles V was turning into an oppressive mausoleum for his parents and grandparents. Beraghetti received commissions to execute frescoes on the lateral walls of the chapel, as well as in the nearby sacristy. We know he got as far as to produce large cartoons or preparatory drawings for these works, but nothing seems to happen, and I've wondered whether or not the demand to try to finish this great altarpiece might have pulled him over to begin practicing as a sculptor, but almost certainly as someone who was gaining facility painting the figures on these altarpieces. The Retablo Mayor was principally executed by a sculptor named Felipe Vigarni, who would become one of Beraghetti's most trusted collaborators and later competitors during the course of his life. So I have to think, beginning at this moment, he's beginning to think about his career, beginning to think about the possibility of branching out into sculptures and more particularly into the world of creating these gigantic painted altarpieces with the gilding, the use of architecture, painting, and sculpture coming together to create a sacred space. He stays in Granada up until late 1521, early 1522. Charles V comes back, lands near Bilbao, and makes his way to Valladolid, which becomes the kind of de facto capital of Charles's realms in Castile. And there, Berruguete shows up in 1522, and he would go on to make Valladolid his home and the site of his principal workshop for the rest of his life. One of the first things that happens to Berruguete when he arrives is Charles V awards him a quite spectacular honor, at least in terms for an artist. He makes Berruguete a notary in the criminal branch of the royal chancellery in Valladolid. This was essentially a sinecure. This was a position that Berruguete was able to reap large amounts of money by doing virtually little work other than having people who could apply stamps to various legal documents, and he would get paid. There was a lot of room for corruption, and the fact that he had this position and that he fought hard to keep it for many, many years of his life speaks to the fact that throughout his life, he was very, very socially aspirant. He was always climbing the social ladder. He had seen how artists were treated and respected in Italy and wanted to bring that own same kind of honor to himself, to be able to rise up the ranks of the nobility in Castile. And he would succeed by the end of his life, becoming the lord of a small town outside of Valladolid. He was also singularly litigious. He was always in lawsuits, which again shows that he didn't want anyone to question his honor. But here, this is just an example of one of these documents that he signed up here that is part of a criminal proceeding that he was ultimately paid for. He didn't let this get in the way of his artistic career, however. It's at this time, about 1524, that we encounter really his earliest work. And it's a figure of Christ as Ecce Homo, the moment that he becomes before taunting crowds on his way to the crucifixion. It was executed for a monastery to the south of Valladolid. We don't know if it was part of a larger altarpiece or whether it was a single figure on top of an altar. But again, it's utterly different from the kind of sculpture we were looking at at the beginning of the lecture, distance about 25 years. The very elongated limbs here, perhaps reflecting his study of poses that he would have studied in ancient sculpture. But I'm particularly drawn to the face of the figure and the real sense of psychology and despondency and despair that it conveys. Again, this is kind of a new hallmark in the sculpture of that particular time. Right at the moment he was executing the Ecce Homo, he was also involved on his first large-scale retablo, which was inherited from another sculptor. Another sculptor had been working on it, died. Berruguete takes it over. And it's important in a number of ways. One of the first has to do with the architecture, and you don't see any of the Gothic tracery, the pointed arches. Here he's using the vocabulary of ancient buildings. These kind of motifs that decorate the surfaces, again, would have been studied on perhaps ancient sarcophagi that he saw in Rome, in Italy, as well as Renaissance buildings. Looking at the sculpture, for instance, this scene of the Annunciation on the left, you get a real sense of dramatic movement of the angel Gabriel coming to the Virgin here, the spiral of drapery, the long features, and then one of the lower figures, a figure about only this big. But you sense the kind of restless energy, the instability of composition, the large hand gripping at the side of the drapery. And these kind of asymmetrical qualities in his compositions would become a hallmark of his style. Berruguete finished this particular retablo about 1526, and immediately, 3 months later, he was offered the job for what would become his masterpiece in the field of retablos. And it was to be the retablo mayor, the high altarpiece of this church in Valladolid, the San Benito el Real, the main Benedictine church in Valladolid. Now, interesting, Berruguete had already built himself a house directly across the street from the monastery. This part is original. It has even classical columns showing that he was a nobleman and owed a kind of palace. This is 19th, 20th century, but his workshop then would have been back in the courtyard. We step into the Church of San Benito, and this is what it looks like today. The altarpiece, and here's a representation of it on the right, was disassembled during the 19th century and moved to the city's sculpture museum. And so if you go to Valladolid today, this is how you will experience it, in different sections that have been installed in a series of galleries in the sculpture museum. The Museo Nacional de Escultura in Valladolid is the principal lender to this exhibition. We went in and were able to negotiate an amazing group of loans from the museum. And it then became our challenge to try to pick from these different sections great figures, but also to give you an experience of what the original retablo would look like. And I go back to a reconstruction here, and all the bits and pieces that you see outlined in red, these are the parts that you will find in the exhibition. We've tried to recreate just one section here that you will see as you go into the exhibition, just to give you an idea of the way painting, sculpture, and architecture work together in a small section. This is, you know, what, 1/8 of the entire retablo, but it'll be towering over your head. This great crucifixion group, larger than life size, that would have been viewed 3 to 4 stories above you, is here, part of the pediment of the great altarpiece on the right. But then some of the most magical parts of the altarpiece are smaller figures that would have been down at eye level, including these two figures here on the left, St. Christopher, and on the right, the sacrifice of Isaac. As you can see with the St. Christopher, you get a real sense of this sweeping energy of him rushing outside of his niche with the baby Christ on his shoulder, turning back, conflicting motions, but again, a dynamic energy. And then this spectacular figure of the sacrifice of Isaac with Abraham, the father, Isaac down below, and the sense of torment, wondering why God has asked him to sacrifice his child, and the young Isaac down below just having no sense of comprehension why his father is about to slit his throat. As you follow the corkscrew of the drapery around, I mean, it's a truly exquisite figure in the energy and the pathos that it delivers. You can see perhaps, and this is a famous comparison, that he may have been looking and thinking especially about Michelangelo, one of the Ignudi from the Sistine ceiling and the corresponding pose. But however he came to the decision to pose the figure in this particular way, it was truly, truly effective. As Berghetti took him 7 years to work on that great altarpiece of San Benito el Real, as he was working in it, he was fielding commissions from all over Castile for many other retablos. Here's a beautiful one in a little chapel in Salamanca. Here's another one in a private chapel in a church in Valladolid, and we were able to snag these three groups here from the central portion that represent the adoration of the Magi, and they're splayed out as though they're really actors on a stage interacting across space to tell the sacred narrative of the Magi and their attendants coming to see the Holy Family and the newborn Christ. They've been recently cleaned for the exhibition and are some of the stars of the show. One of his later retablos from the end of his life, it raises the question of how he kept up with the enormous demand for work. These were enterprises that required architectural know-how, sculpting of figures, the intricate painting of all the figures, and then trying to maneuver all these bits and pieces to different parts of Castile. The central important thing to consider is that he was really the master of a workshop. He was trying to guide a consistent look and feel across all the different projects and commissions that came to him. And the way that he was able to guide his workers with his drawings. I really think that Beregete saw himself first and foremost as a designer of sacred spaces, and that he relied on his facility with making beautiful drawings, and these are two of my favorites, to help guide his assistants to elaborate compositions. This is an interesting drawing that is part of the discovery of the exhibition. There's writing on the back that's part of a lawsuit involving a altarpiece that's now destroyed that would have been in a little town south of Castile. No one knew anything about this, but this must be a preparatory drawing for a group of figures he was envisioning for that particular altarpiece. This must have been for an Assumption of the Virgin that he was planning. It's very much conceived as a three-dimensional figure. And again, giving this to his very, very talented assistants, he could sit back and be the mastermind of the entire operation. The final part of Beregete's career, he had his great workshop in Valladolid, but he would end up opening a second workshop in the city of Toledo. And it was in Toledo during the last, between 1539 and his death in 1561, were really one of the most important chapters of his life, where he really ascended to be the great force of Spanish Renaissance sculpture played out in the beautiful town of Toledo, and in particular in the city's great cathedral here. Beregete was hired in 1539 by the Archbishop of Toledo to come and execute one half of the reliefs that decorate the choir stalls here and the alabaster reliefs up above. 1539, there only existed one row of seats that dated to 1500. The Archbishop Juan Pardo Tavera had ambitions to completely transform the church and wanted a dynamic new choir to do that. And he pitted Beregete against his former collaborator, Felipe Vigarni. Vigarni was awarded the seats and the reliefs on the right side, while Beregete worked on those on the left. Here's the earlier seats, and here's a sample of the reliefs that Beregete executed. And one of the standout figures is this figure of Job, just in the way that he seems to be launching his body through space, the way his hands and drapery break the frame of the work of sculpture. There's a tenseness in his body. It's truly an expressive and nearly unprecedented figure in the sculpture of its time. And to draw that point, I just bring up John Bologna, who was the great sculptor working in Florence during the latter part, last quarter of the 16th century. And it's only, you know, nearly 40 years later that in Florentine sculpture, you begin to get a similar sense of energy coming into the sculpture of its time. But it very much drives the point that Beregete was a truly innovative force in sculpture, but one that has gone largely appreciated, because I don't know how many of you have been to Toledo, and then how many of you have taken pains to get past the little rope and try to get up close to see these works. So most unfortunately, Beregete has remained in comparative obscurity to sculptors like John Bologna and even later Bernini. This is a work by Felipe Vigarni from the other side, and just to put Beregete in comparison, contrast with his contemporaries, it's Jacob wrestling with an angel. But there's no sense of the kind of action. They look like they're in some kind of awkward embrace. Vigarni is more interested in all this kind of fussy drapery and decoration and these very sort of generic faces, which stands, again, in sharp contrast to what Beregete was doing at this point in time. As he was finishing these, he and assistants were working on the alabaster reliefs up above. And again, there's some absolutely extraordinary figures, such as this one of Methuselah, again, sort of foisting foisting out of the frame of the niche, looks like about to fly directly through space. And again, qualities that we don't necessarily associate with sculpture from circa 1540, especially not in Spain. The success of Beregete's alabaster reliefs here and the walnut reliefs down below earned him the commission for the crowning sculpture that decorates and presides over the choir of Toledo Cathedral. It represents the transfiguration of Christ, and again, in its theatricality, it was totally unprecedented for the time. Here you have the apostles down below cowering as they look up to Christ here, who's revealing himself in light. And the way, again, that they're acting across space and showing real reactions to one another, this is something that represented quite a novelty in the sculpture of his time. The other place Berighetti would work in Toledo and create his last great masterpiece is in this building here. This is the hospital that was founded by that great Archbishop of Toledo, Archbishop Juan Pardo de Tavera. This is the part of the hospital down here that would have rooms for the sick, and there's even a pharmacy that still exists. But it was back in this chapel where Berighetti would ultimately execute the tomb of the cardinal. The cardinal died in 1545, and it was his heirs in 1554 who hired Berighetti to execute this tomb. Berighetti very quickly arranged for marble to be quarried in far-off Carrara in Italy. We have all the payment receipts of how it made its way to Alicante and was then, through a series of ox carts, brought to Toledo, a very costly and difficult enterprise that would have only been reserved for a great figure like an archbishop and a cardinal. As you turn to look more closely at the work, it's in a little bit of a sad state. Unfortunately, there was a bombardment during the Spanish Civil War that hit the church and exploded near to the tomb, and there were other marauders who came in, which explains some of the reason that some of the figures are not in perfect shape. But there are passages, such as this great figure of Santiago coming and fighting the Moors here, that show an incredible sensitivity to carving. And I have to think, as difficult it is in many situations to really understand when we're seeing Berighetti's hand, I think the sensitivity that we see here must speak that this is, in fact, part of the tomb that Berighetti really exercised personal control over. Here's the cardinal himself. The eyes were a bit damaged during the Spanish Civil War, but it's a really kind of spooky figure, a spooky portrait. Quite remarkably, in comparison to other tombs and effigies of the time, he's shown with his eyes open, just looking up, realizing that these are his final moments of life. And quite incredibly, Berighetti has juxtaposed this kind of serene face with this screaming, grotesque figure to almost kind of drive the sense that this is really about the difference between life and death. When I was working with our photographer to take this particular image, I really wanted to get the nose of the cardinal right here looking up at this painting. It's a painting by El Greco. Later, when El Greco would come to Toledo, he would be hired to execute a series of paintings in the Ospedal Tavera in this chapel. And I conclude my talk just thinking about El Greco and the relationship with Berighetti. This is our great painting of Luacawan by El Greco. El Greco arrives in Toledo in 1577. Berighetti dies in 1561, just as he's putting the finishing touches on that tomb. He in fact, seeks remedy there in the hospital and passes away in the hospital. But when El Greco comes in 1577, I have no doubt that he recognizes that Berighetti is the real kind of great artist that he can seek inspiration from there in Toledo. And that as he's creating these absolutely transcendent works, totally bizarre, such as this one, he's going down to Toledo Cathedral, looking at figures like the Job, and realizing, in fact, that he kind of represents the artistic heir of Berighetti there in Toledo. In fact, there survives a copy of El Greco's copy of Vasari. And in that copy, El Greco has gone through and highlighted the passage about Berigete being the one who was invited to participate in that competition involving the Lawakawan. And maybe something there that the other next great Spanish painter needed to be one who could execute an incredible representation of the Lawakawan helped to inspire the painting that is with us now. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.